From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the summer of 1972, a young man named Harry Walker wound up in Yellowstone National Park. He had left the pressures of the family farm in Alabama and the responsibilities of the National Guard. He needed a break, so he went on a road trip. And one night when he was camping in the park with a friend, he was dragged away and killed by a grizzly bear. That story played out during a debate about how you manage wild places. Do you leave nature alone, you know, not manipulate it, just sit back and see how species interact or compete? Or do you step in, try and establish some kind of equilibrium in ecosystems with policies and projects? In his new book, Jordan Fisher Smith uses the case of Harry Walker to work through those questions, which, of course, are still being asked today. He'll join us to talk about it after the news.
Love what you hear? Radio West podcast is made possible in part by thousands of KUER sustainers, along with Albion Financial Group, with more than 30 years of offering individualized attention to help clients make decisions toward their wealth management goals. Find out more online at albionfinancial.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here's one question at the heart of a legal battle that played out in 1975. How much should human beings get involved in trying to engineer nature? You know, put out forest fires, manage vegetation, control animal populations. Here's another question. Just what does natural mean? Because it turns out it's kind of hard to pin it down. That legal case is a tragic one. In the summer of 1972, a young man who had left his family farm in Alabama and traveled west on a kind of journey of self-discovery ends up in Yellowstone National Park, where he is dragged away from his campsite one night, killed and partially consumed by a grizzly bear. The family of the young man, Harry Walker was his name, sues the federal government. The argument made by the family's brilliant attorney was that when managers of Yellowstone had closed the open dumps in the park, where bears had gone for decades to eat, they made conditions more dangerous for the humans in the park. That's what, he says, led to the death of Harry Walker. In his new book, Jordan Fisher Smith uses that Walker case to explore this ongoing question of how you control nature and what does that word mean anymore. The book is called Engineering Eden, The True Story of a Violent Death, a Trial, and the Fight Over Controlling Nature. Jordan Fisher Smith is joining us today to talk about it. He worked for some 21 years as a park ranger in California, in Wyoming, Idaho, and Alaska. He's going to be in Salt Lake City this week. On Wednesday, he'll be here. He's giving a lecture at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. We'll give you more details about that a little bit later on the program. Today in the program, Jordan Fisher Smith is joining us from the studios of NPR member station KVMR in Nevada City, California. Jordan Fisher Smith, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you, Doug. It's great to be with you today.
I want to begin with this is a I didn't know the story of Harry Walker, the court case anyway, that plays out in 1975.
No, nobody did. It was, you know,
is that
sort
right?
of a forgotten case, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it was not something that you see written up in law books.
When did you come across it, and when did you think about that case as serving this bigger message, this idea of how you control nature or how you manage nature?
Well, the answer to that is that this case was knocking on the door for, you know, for my entire career. I didn't know it. Bits and pieces, little bits of this story had come to me over the years, and I'd heard there'd been a lawsuit. And I'd heard that that after it, a bunch of people from Yellowstone showed up at Yosemite, and then there was a scandal in Yosemite where you know, a rock climber found 22 dead bears at the bottom of a cliff. The
yeah.
rangers had gotten so frustrated with the conditions there that they were doing away with these bears. And but it wasn't you know, basically I set out to study this, the questions that you just asked. I mean, when we damage or break nature, how do we fix it? In the process, how much should we respect nature's autonomy? I mean,
yeah.
is there still an autonomous nature that we should respect, or are we just in charge now?
Yeah.
How much should we allow ourselves to control or manipulate nature in order to save it? And then what if we get it seriously wrong, as maybe they did in this case, and somebody dies? And I had set out to study this by traveling all over the country, you know, from the Arctic to the Mexican border, and looking at what was going on in wilderness areas. And I was on one of these. I was actually doing a magazine job for Discover Magazine about an aspect of the struggle at Yellowstone. And I stumbled upon these couple of cardboard boxes containing 1,745 pages of trial transcripts. And when I opened the boxes and began leafing through these papers, these old legal size trial transcripts, I saw the names of Starker Leopold, the son of Aldo Leopold, testifying on one side of the case, and Frank Craighead, the legendary grizzly biologist, on the other side, testifying against him, and I was sort of hooked.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll talk about both of those characters and more, because it's full of really fascinating, it's kind of a biography of a lot of these different stories. It's interesting the way you put the story together. You sort of wind it. The case and then history. So I want to – let's just talk about the case first of all. Just some basics get out of the way. And maybe we need to introduce Steven Zetterberg here. He is this kind of brilliant attorney who's quite successful and really fascinating. And talk about the case that he's making.
Well, Steven Zetterberg, you know, was a sort of surprise. I mean, one of the things that happens, you know, when you write – I write narrative nonfiction, and I guess some people call it creative nonfiction, which I'm not sure I like that title, because it suggests that you could be creative with the facts or what people said, or, you know, you could embellish it a little bit to make it a better story. I just don't give myself the right But when you get involved in narrative nonfiction, at least for me, what comes out is the characters. Right. I mean, I set out in life, you know, as a park ranger to write about nature, but I really just have become fascinated with people. And many of the people in my stories are in some kind of extreme situation facing a struggle with or about nature. And Steven Zetterberg was such a surprise package, because he just, I mean, I wish I knew the man. He's a wonderful guy, you know. He's a World War II veteran. He worked on a Coast Guard cutter out of Pearl Harbor chasing Japanese submarines. His brother was killed in the Battle of the Bulge. And he comes back to L.A. after the war to practice law. And he's sort of a classic plaintiff's attorney, meaning that his belief is that his job is to represent his clients, you know, all the way.
Yeah.
He basically never stops his efforts on behalf of his clients. And somehow through this story of Harry Walker, he becomes connected with an Alabama farm family, Harry's family. Mm-hmm. These people had never contested a traffic ticket. They didn't know any attorneys. They were simple people. And after Harry's death, because Harry's death occurs in the middle of this struggle about how you manage nature, an environmental activist who's trying to save the grizzly bear in the Rockies, and at that point, the Yellowstone population is pretty endangered due to these changes at the park. And an environmental activist connects the Alabama family with this amazing attorney Zetterberg and convinces them to sue the government. And here these simple people from Alabama go up against the full might of the Department of Interior, and you're off and running.
Yeah. They'd never even been on an airplane before, the Walker
They
family.
Had never been on an airplane.
Yeah.
So that's right. So Zetterberg, you know, when it's time for the trial, Zetterberg arranges to have them flown to Los Angeles. And it's the first time they've ever set foot on an airplane.
What's weird about maybe it's not weird, but I think it's pretty telling that Zetterberg manages to get this case tried in Los Angeles, which has nothing to do with Wyoming, of course, where Harry Walker is killed, or Alabama, where the Walkers are from. But it shows how clever he is and how, as you say in the book, he sees the courts as a means for little people to confront powerful adversary. So he's very clever and he's very passionate. That's an important part of the story.
Yeah, the fact that this thing went on in L.A. entirely because of Zetterberg, meaning that normally, you know, the federal courts are scattered around the country, and the question of a venue where a particular trial will take place has to do with either the plaintiff or living in that state, or the event in question occurred there, or in the case where there's assets say somebody suing somebody over a bank account or money or interstate transportation of something that is there. Yeah. Well, none of those things was true in this case. This is a death that occurred in Wyoming, and the dead man was from Alabama. And, you know, Zetterberg literally levitated this case into L.A. So he drops it into this federal court down on Spring Street in downtown L.A., and it's a completely alien environment. You have these Alabama farmers and Park Service people being flown from, you know, from Wyoming. And meanwhile, and this isn't in the book, but outside the courthouse in the surrounding blocks, you know, by that time, downtown L.A. was kind of in decline, and yeah. all the energy was going out to the suburbs. And so there's a serial murderer working the streets outside the courthouse at night as this trial is going on.
Wow.
It's a very foreign environment for this story to take its legal form.
Zetterberg is arguing, and I want to read a bit of what you say here, because one of the things that he's arguing is he wants to indict the government at Yellowstone for, here's how you put it, believing that nature would forget our past mistakes the minute we tried to remedy them. Zetterberg doesn't think that's how nature works, and that's sort of the crux of the argument here. So take us through that.
Can I just digress for a moment?
Sure.
I was listening to that question, and I realized you've actually read this book, and I noticed that you're raising funds over there today. I mean, I hope people, you know, in your listening area understand that this is the smart place on the dial, you know, in Utah, and I hope that they're donating to this fund drive of yours, because when you ask these questions, I think this guy's really done his homework.
Well, that's nice.
So go ahead, okay, ask good. The question.
You did your pitch. Good job.
No, it wasn't. I mean, I just, you know, to an author who's on the road like me, this really matters. You know, you go on in some media, and they really don't have time to think much, and they really don't have time to read the book. And the questions are shallow. They've read the press release from the publisher. But this is just a wonderful place for us to talk.
Well,
so go ahead. Ask that question.
Nice of you to say. Good. Well, there. Yeah. So there's the question. It is this idea of how does nature work? Zetterberg says it doesn't. I mean, and we can talk about the dumps and the way bears were acclimated to feeding from the dumps. We'll sort of get to that. But what's the basic question at the heart of all this?
Well, the thing that hangs over the whole situation at that point is that and I think we haven't mentioned this yet, but Harry leaves home in Alabama and goes on the Great American Road Trip. And it's the summer of 1972.
Yep.
And Take It Easy, you know, the Eagles sort of road anthem infused with those bluegrass riffs and just kind of a wide open highway feel is all over the radio, and everybody's got their thumb out, you know. So he's drifting yeah. around, and it's the first time away from home for any, you know, he's a dairy farmer. They don't leave. They have to be there for milking twice a day. So he's on the road, and he has this amazing couple of weeks traveling around the United States, and then he winds up in Yellowstone, and he happens to be there. He didn't mean to go there. He just got picked. Somebody told him when he was in Colorado that it would be a good thing to see. So he goes up there, and he happens to arrive in the middle of the 100th anniversary of the park.
Yeah.
Now, you know, this is a park that was designated in 1872. That's 4 years before Custer's Last Stand. So it's a radical experiment for human beings. Nobody's ever done anything like this before. And so Yellowstone becomes a physical embodiment of our learning curve in dealing with nature. And I think that's what fascinates me about this story. So he shows up in the middle of this festivities around the 100th anniversary. And suffice it to say that 100 years of any human enterprise, be it a national park or a nuclear plant, is long enough for things to go seriously wrong,
yeah.
and they have. So by about 1960, scientists have enough sophistication in looking at nature that they know that it's gone wrong, and then there's a process of figuring out what to do about it. there's two schools of thought at that point. Yeah. One is represented by Starker Leopold, who's Elder Leopold's oldest son, and he's a big presence in this book. Yeah. And he says, you know, once you mess things up or you push things out of whack, you can't just walk away. You're in a dance with nature. And if you just walk away, it may just keep spinning out in some direction, right, like our climate may be right now, you know. So you have to stay in contact with it, and you may have to manipulate it back into some semblance of naturalness.
Right.
The other side of the debate is represented by the chief scientist of Yellowstone at the time, by 1967, Glenn Cole, yeah, who's another big presence in this book. Cole says, you know, the way things got messed up is us messing with it, and the way to fix it is just stop touching it. Just leave it alone and let nature find its equilibrium. And, of course, this comes down from this ancient belief that there's some sort of, you know, balance of nature, yeah, that nature wants to go back to.
So those are the sort of – this is the dispute that's playing out. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the idea of Eden. Yellowstone, of course, is established as a public park or a pleasuring ground. And it comes as part of this kind of reform movement against the devastation that had been left in the mid-1800s, clear-cutting and mining. And, you know, there was all kind of industrial excesses. You talk about slavery, of course, is in play, and child labor and poverty and pollution and cruelty to animals. And there are these beliefs then that are rooted, you say, in romanticism. So explain the significance of the idea of Eden. What's the idea of nature that's reflected in the word Eden at that time?
Well, you know, a couple of things. That word came into this book and became its title because of a sign that was posted, you know, one of those sort of information placards, roadside placard, sitting at a tilt facing the road on a big stone pillar in the Lamar Valley, which is a beautiful valley in the northeastern part of Yellowstone, where people go to watch wildlife grazing across these great meadows. And that sign said, "An American Eden." Yeah. And the image of Eden, or the Elysian Fields or something like it, you know, goes way back into the ancients. It's really the idea of a sort of a peaceable kingdom, mm-hmm, you know, and the implication is before we messed with it,
right,
the messing with it is equivalent to the fall, you know, the fall of humanity from a state of perfection. So, you know, Eden comes up over and over again. Whenever the environmentalists are trying to save some wilderness area, they say, you know, it's a high country Eden, or it's a, you know, the word Eden comes up over and over again in relation to beautiful places and public lands. So I think it's there in the book just to evoke the aspiration, yeah, of what national parks should be, other than just a place to, you know, have a picnic.
Right.
Is there a part of the original world before we messed with it?
Doesn't it also express the word a kind of misperception about what might be natural? Because you talk about kind of the myth that Yellowstone was pristine when white people first encountered it. But you talk about how it's more complicated than that. Given the interplay with the way humans have always kind of manipulated the lands that we've been on.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, a lot of environmental historians and a lot of writers now are talking about this issue that, you know, there really was no, you know, Edenic, mm-hmm, kind of starting point. But I think we have to be really careful with that. And I think the thing that people have, it's even being taught in the schools now that, you know, it turns out that the Indians, the Native Americans, did a lot of controlling the land or a lot of manipulating, chiefly through fire, but also through predation. You know, there's this sort of longstanding theory that, you know, there's a moment in our prehistory when, at the end of the Ice Age, last Ice Age, when 32 genera of, you know, of large mammals just sort of suddenly disappear from North America. And this happens to have occurred at the same moment that the so-called Clovis tradition, or the, you know, these people that walked across from Asia, show up. So the implication is that they kind of had a party and wiped out a bunch of animals when they got here. So, you know, I think that this idea has gotten conflated with logging and mining and drilling and even maybe changing the atmosphere. And I think we have to be very careful about noticing, first of all, the so-called overkill hypothesis about the disappearance of mammals has never been actually proven. There's a good deal of, I think, of evidence that it might be true, but we don't know for sure. But secondly, the scale of what's going on under Indian management is so different than what's going on with us now. So I think you have to be careful to notice the difference between our industrial culture and Native Americans.
We're going to head to a break here in just a moment. I wanted to ask you what influence being a park ranger had on the way you not just presented the story, but what sort of things you had to... I mean, I wonder if it represented a kind of challenge to your own ideas. You know, you had your own kind of sense of this as a park ranger. And I'm wondering if some of your own ideas, you had to confront some of your own ideas, some of your own perceptions in telling this story.
Very much so. I mean, I think I began writing this story because the whole issue of manipulating and controlling nature really bothered me. And I wanted to know more about it. And I was troubled by it. And probably, you know, my book Nature Noir, my last book, was really about the way that if you save a place and you just watch over it and leave it alone, it'll come back. You know, that the canyons of the American River that I wrote about in that book are designated to go under a Great Western Dam, and for some reason the whole dam gets slowed down, and meanwhile the place goes so wild that the first Californian in the 20th century to be killed and eaten by a lion, a mountain lion, dies in that that sort of Paleolithic death in this place that was sort of just allowed to go wild again. But I think that I had a prejudice against messing with nature. Mm-hmm. And I think I had to really question that in this book.
Jordan Fisher-Smith is with us. He is the author of the book Engineering Eden, A True Story of a Violent Death, a Trial and the Fight Over Controlling Nature. He is going to be in Utah on Wednesday giving a lecture at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. It's at 12:15. It's free. It's open to the public. We have details about it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the summer of 1972, a young man named Harry Walker left his family farm in Alabama and heads out for adventure in Yellowstone. That's where he ends up anyway. He was killed by a grizzly bear there, and there's a court battle that comes from this a few years later that raises these big questions about how we manage America's national parks, what you think about nature. The writer Jordan Fisher-Smith traces Walker's fatal path, which led to these questions that we're talking about today. The book is called Engineering Eden, The True Story of a Violent Death, A Trial and the Fight Over Controlling Nature. Smith is going to be in Utah on Wednesday, a little later in the week. We'll give you some details about that. He's joining us today to talk about the story. I think Jordan Fisher-Smith, I don't know, it's hard to say who are my favorite. They had to have been among them anyway, my favorites, the Craighead brothers. Let's talk about Frank and John Craighead. They were, I guess all twins are this way, but talk about a mind meld in terms of their relationship with nature.
These guys are, Craighead twins, John and Frank, are sort of, as you know, among the main characters in the book. And they really end up in a great conflict with the Park Service because Park Service has taken on this idea that, you know, to fix things, we just need to leave it alone.
Yeah.
And the Craigheads are sort of very modern guys. They born 100 years ago in 1916. You know, they come on the scene. They're the sons of a Department of Agriculture entomologist who really appreciated and knew a lot about nature. So he takes them out hiking right away, you know, along the Potomac River where they grew up, outside of Washington, D.C., and Chevy Chase, Maryland. And they just come into life with a fire for nature, and they get very interested in birds of prey. Mm-hmm. And they come into their lives right at the moment that essentially ecology becomes a field the year after they're born, and wildlife management doesn't exist until, you know, they're well on their way. And they help invent wildlife management. They go into World War II and end up developing a program, survival training program. And after the war, they end up during the Cold War, they're teaching spies to survive, you know, in the wilderness. They're working for the OSS and in the Strategic Air Command, teaching people how to, you know, probably get dropped into Russia and travel down rivers on rafts and things and live off the land. And so they get this kind of awareness of space age technology and end up inventing the radio collar, right. You know, which is a device that's so common in wildlife management that we never really think about where it came from. So these two guys have a very nuanced view of what's going on at Yellowstone. And by putting radio collars on bears, they quickly realize that bears don't care about park boundaries.
Yeah.
And that in order to manage grizzlies, you're going to have to stop thinking about national park grizzlies and forest grizzlies and grizzlies that are rampaging on ranches and just say grizzlies. So they invent this notion that we now call the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem, which is some 18 to 22 million acres from the Wind River Mountains up into Montana. They're these amazing guys. And as you may know, John died just over a week ago. And I was with the family yesterday in Missoula paying my respects.
Yeah, they're remarkable people. And I guess we should tell the story, because this seems crucial to what happens to Harry Walker. You mentioned of all the sort of modern accommodations that have come to Yellowstone by the 1950s and 1960s, the waste disposal is still pretty basic, pretty ancient. All the trash goes into these open dumps in the parks. And this was interesting to me. By 1889, you said the bears started coming to the dumps. And so the hotels kind of see this as an opportunity to draw the tourists. It's kind of an entertainment opportunity. I didn't realize they actually set up seating.
Yeah, very quickly, as these bears start to emerge from the forest and feed in these garbage pits near the hotels, people sort of informally started to go out there and watch them. And the hoteliers quickly realized that there was a potential for public entertainment. You have to remember that, the thing that's interesting about Yellowstone is that our attitudes and beliefs and the way that we see nature are evolving, mm-hmm. you know, as Yellowstone is evolving. So it becomes a physical manifestation of the way we see nature. And I suppose this was the Discovery Channel of its time that essentially they set up bleachers and in some cases bussed people. You know, in Yosemite they had a little bus that took people to the dumps, and the garbage truck or garbage wagon would show up at the appointed time, and people would watch the bears eating.
Now the big question is, of course, how should we stop this? I mean, clearly there seems to be a consensus of we should stop feeding the bears at these dumps. They need to go back into nature and eat like they would in a quote-unquote natural way. But this becomes a big question that plays out for the Harry Walker case. Do you just all of a sudden stop feeding them, or do you ease into it? That seems like a big question. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that part.
Right. Well, this was sort of at the center of this whole question about naturalness, because clearly it becomes clear by as early as the 1939, 1940, people are realizing this isn't natural. We shouldn't really be having bears get fed in national parks, and the director of the Park Service issues a memorandum that says every species will be allowed to go through its natural struggle for survival unaided. But really, the trouble starts when they try to shut it down.
Yeah.
And this is just a case in point about that. In order to get natural ends, you may not always use natural means.
Right.
This comes out now, in the question of, if we have a really invasive alien or exotic plants in wilderness areas, should we be using herbicide? Mm-hmm. And of course, herbicide is used widely to get rid of some of these things that really will take over and kill other species. But in this case, they really start to have a problem when they start to shut things down. They close when they close the last of these what they called bear shows or these feeding operations where people would come out and watch the bears feeding on garbage. When they shut that down, there's hell to pay in the campgrounds. Bears just move from where garbage was in the dump to where it came from in the campgrounds.
Yeah.
And they rampage and a woman is killed in the early 1940s. So they've shut down the feeding operation. The dumps stay closed for a long time, but along comes Glenn Cole,
yeah,
and Jack Anderson, the chief scientist of Yellowstone, 1967, and the new superintendent. They say, this cannot be allowed to be present by the time of this big centennial we're going to have. We are going to have a natural population of bears for the centennial. They had scientists coming and managers from all over the world to this great conference, on park management. We are not going to allow this to continue. And the Craigheads said, oh, wait a moment, you better be a little careful about what you do. Somebody will die. And, of course, somebody did.
Yeah. I want to go back to Starker Leopold, and as you say, a prominent player in this story and a remarkable person. He studies under Joseph Grinnell at Berkeley. And of course, he's got that. He comes from that remarkable family culture. Aldo Leopold, of course, is his father. And he goes to the Sierra Madre early on in his sort of training. And he is able to see an ecosystem with all its processes intact. And you say this informs his thinking really for the rest of his life. I wanted you to talk about this because there's a moment when he also sees there when he's in Mexico, these Mormon guides tossing lighted matches into the grass. This idea of, which gives you a sense, again, of manipulating to some degree the natural process. To talk about what he learns in Mexico.
Right. Well, some Euro-American populations picked up this practice of burning from Indians.
Yeah.
And it's certainly true in the southeastern United States, where woods burning was picked up by settlers and cattle herders and so on from Indians that had used it before to kind of clear out the brush and reduce the populations of snakes and chiggers and ticks and so on, and improve access to the woods. I think there's a lot of evidence that the Great Plains didn't have trees on them because they burned so much. So, certainly there's a lot of Indian fire in North America. It's not true everywhere. For example, high altitude places like, Rocky Mountain National Park or Tioga Pass in Yosemite, those places weren't burning that much because, the forests were sparse and the grass was green. But a lot of the United States was being burned. So Starker, it's Starker's father that organizes this trip. It's his second time down. And the question they're trying to ask is, you know, if we're going to restore ecosystems, and Aldo was already thinking that way, you know, if we're going to restore ecosystems, we've got to have some idea of what they look like when they're still whole. Aldo looked around the United States by that time, and, you know, the Department of Interior and Department of Agriculture had pretty much finished off the wolves. They'd seriously reduced the cougars. Grizzly bears were crowded onto a couple little national parks, Glacier and Yellowstone in the Northern Rockies. And so there really, you know, wasn't a healthy predator suite. And they'd also been involved in a war on fire. Mm-hmm. So Aldo Leopold said, where can I go to see something that still has those two elements, fire and predators? And he found this and took his son with him in the Sierra Madre in Mexico. And, of course, it was beautiful. I mean, they noticed that the trees were widely spaced, and there was this luxuriant bunch grass growing everywhere between them, which held the, when the rains came, the bunch grass held the rains and just kind of bled it off slowly into the creeks, clear creeks with fish in them. And everywhere they went, you know, deer jumped out in front of them, and yet they saw kills, wolf kills and lion kills everywhere they went too. So it was an amazing experience, and Starker, for the rest of his life, remembered this as a sort of reference point. And he spent the rest of his life doing what his father had started to do, which was to bring back fire and bring back predators.
But of course, his idea of essentially manipulating vegetation was outrageously controversial, generally accepted within the Park Service, though. But he creates what's called the Starker, the Leopold Report. This is, maybe you should mention something about that, because it plays a role in the story as well.
Well, you know, you're right here, but I want to correct one thing, that the Park Service had always manipulated something.
Right, it's true.
The difference was they'd done it for really bad reasons.
Yeah.
David Graeber, who appears later in the book as a student of Starker's and carries us into the present, called what they were doing through most of the history of the Park Service cowboy biology.
Right.
And forgive me for that. It was not a slur against the cowboys, but more against that particular brand of biology that was just seat of the pants biology. And so what changes there is that there is, by the 50s, with people like the Craigheads and Starker, Leopold, this desire to do things for the right reasons. And so right at the point that they say we should start doing, we're going to end up manipulating, but we need to do it for really good scientific reasons. At that very moment, there's also a kind of romanticism that emerges in all over the United States and in Europe and so on, a kind of revival of this sense of connection to nature, what we call the environmental movement. And out of that comes one movement that comes out of it is the leave it alone thing, mm-hmm. you know, that the Wilderness Act of 1964 says, you know, man is a visitor, does not remain. And so right at the moment that Starker is trying to promote this idea of careful manipulation for scientific reasons, there's another whole school that says, stop manipulating, just mm-hmm. stop it. Just walk away and leave it alone. Starker is really, you know, against that. He does propose things that people are uncomfortable with. Wilderness advocates of the time say he's trying to make national parks into Disneylands, where everything is, you know, sort of controlled. And as you walk by, Abraham Lincoln stands up and gives the Gettysburg Address.
Right. How much do you want to give away about what happens in the case? Because we can leave that alone. I mean, it's an interesting...
The case becomes a focal point. I think the thing that interested me about the case is that it becomes a focal point for this struggle of, you know, what is nature? What is natural? How much should we be involved in manipulating it? Do we know enough that we're really dealing with now? I mean, the whole reason, you know, that... I think that your audience will know that that historians, and I'm not a historian, but this is a historical story, their agenda is always really to talk about the present, the same way that science fiction writers appear to be talking about a planet far in the future in a civilization much more advanced than us, mm-hmm. but it's really their agenda to tell us about our own civilization, you know? So I guess suffice it to say that this trial focused a great battle between these forces about what nature is and how we should respond with it, and it's still going on today.
Yeah.
But I will say that the family, you know, that the family won. It went to appeals court. They lost. It went up to the Supreme Court. It was kicked back down, and the appeals court decision was let to stand. It went to Congress, and they were involved in this process. Instead of grieving their son and allowing this process to go on, the grieving process, they were kept for 6 years. And in the end, Harry's father went out of business and more or less lost his farm.
That's the other part of the story that is really interesting that we didn't really have much time to get into, and that is the pressures that Harry Walker is dealing with, the family farm, and of course, you know, going into the whole question of Vietnam is playing out, and the government who's trying to make this case raises these questions about Harry Walker's character, whether they had been negligent in their camping, whether there was a him, because he basically goes AWOL from the National Guard, and you say in the book that the government tries to make this case that it's not only a character flaw, but it was a fatal one, that he is negligent or nonchalant, that he had tried to avoid authorities, for example. Anyway, I don't want to give too much away.
I mean, it sounds to me like Harry really got up and walked around for you, and you know, and I think, you know, that this is what's happened to me as a nature writer. I started out really wanting to write about nature and the environment. And, of course, I wound up writing about people all the time.
Yeah,
And you know, really, Doug, you know, if you look at the environmental crisis, you know, it's not a nature problem. It's a people problem. So I think maybe my work as a storyteller has gravitated towards people, but also just because I find them fascinating, you know. And as a writer, I think what I really want, you know, the great teacher of fiction, John Gardner, once said that what the reader wants is an unbroken dream. And my goal as a writer is to tell a story that just where the characters, where you see them in your mind's eye, you know, and they come alive, especially these amazing people like the Starker Leopolds and the Craigheads, but also this simple guy, really a good guy, Harry Walker, that walked into the middle of his great struggle he knew nothing about. You know, that's sort of one of the classic story forms, is a just a person who doesn't know walking into the middle of something really big.
You say toward the end of the book that we have to accept our role as stewards and not pretend we can just stand back. So when you see a couple in, I think it was in Yellowstone, who found a baby bison and threw it in the back of the van, or people taking selfies with bison or herds of elk, or how are you thinking now about the way land managers, about park managers are trying to, on one hand, bring people into these places, and on the other hand, keep them as quote-unquote natural as possible? Where are you coming down these days on that?
Well, I think my friend David Quammen was the one who said that, you know, that the way that national parks evolved in the United States is sort of an anomaly. Because, after all, if you go to Africa and you want to go watch lions and zebras and stuff, you have to stay inside the Land Rover, you know? So in America, we have this amazing form that's really quite wonderful where, you know, to this day, with all the courts and lawyers and everything, people are still allowed to just park their car and walk off into a field into the middle of, you know, large carnivores. And the fact is that, you know, really with all the people who go to these parks, I mean, last year in 2015, Yellowstone had over 4 million. Yosemite had over 4 million. Rocky Mountain National Park had over 4 million. And really, you know, not too many people come to grief. We hear, you know, news stories about this stuff. In a study the National Park Service did of causes of death from 2007 to 2013 inclusive, there were 4 people in the whole country who were killed by bears, right? Yeah. But in the same period of time, there were over 200 of them died in auto accidents in the national parks. Drowning is the largest cause of death in national parks. 360 65, I think, people died in that 7-year period in drownings. So, you know, the wildlife is, I mean, we know these things happen. I was just in Yellowstone and watched people approaching animals in an irresponsible way. But I don't think we should get too carried away with thinking that we're loving the parks to death. I think we really have to look at the biotic fabric of the parks as being the most important. Human behavior problems come and go. They've always been there. You know, I worked with people in parks and watched all kinds of stupid things happen. But I think we have to keep our eye on the prize right now and look at whether the desert tortoise is going to keep living in Utah.
Jordan Fisher-Smith. His book is called Engineering Eden, The True Story of a Violent Death, a Trial, and the Fight Over Controlling Nature. He's going to be in Utah on Wednesday afternoon giving a lecture at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. It's at 12:15. It's free. It's open to the public. You can get all the details on our website.
You know, we're going to be in a courtroom. Did you know that?
Yeah. Is that ironic or that's perfect?
I think it's really cool because this is a courtroom drama. And apparently they've got us talk is going to be given at the Quinney College of Law, Level 6, in the Moot Courtroom, which is where they do these sort of enactments of famous cases for students. I think that's so cool.
It is cool.
Really looking forward to that.
Jordan Fisher-Smith, thanks for the time.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.